afternoon. Last time, we talked about page tables more. We did some practice dividing up addresses into page numbers and page offsets. This kind of split of the bits of the address was possible because we chose our page sizes, this unit we divided up the memory into, both the memory the program could see and the actual real memory. We chose these units to be powers of two, and that meant the lower bits of the address were the page offset, where in each of these, one of these units we were, and the upper bits were the page number, which of those units that address mapped to. And we had started with page tables where we just, you know, had a small table, but we learned that, well, they're going to be a little big. So our first solution to that, first step, was we would store them in memory, that we'd represent our page table entries, each row of that table we had, which said, you know, for this virtual address, we have this physical address. We represent that as some sort of integer. The processor would decide how that encoding would work. We'd have an array of those integers, and we'd have a register the operating system would set that would point to the beginning of that array, called the page table base register. I guess we'd say start of the page table array, you know, the address of the start of the page table array. And we talked about, well, given that the processor has that, what is it actually doing? And it's taking that pointer to the beginning of the array, and it's doing an array lookup. So it's taking an index, which is going to be based on the page number in the program addresses, so the virtual page number. And we're doing an array lookup. So when we do an array lookup, we need to advance in the array that many entries, and each entry in the array is not probably 1 byte, but probably larger than that, because our page table entries need to store a page number, a physical page number, that's usually bigger than a byte. And we mentioned that these page table entries have like a valid bit. We'll also talk about some extra bits they might have today. And we're going to check that bit to make sure that the OS actually mapped this part of memory to something. If the OS didn't, it's going to leave the valid bit as a zero, and the processor will trigger a fault. So ask the operating system what to do using the exception mechanism we talked about earlier. If it is valid, the processor gets a physical page number, and it's going to combine that physical page number with the page offset from the original address and access memory at that location. That's what the program's memory access actually turns into. It doesn't access memory at the location the program requested. It accesses at this translated location based on the entry we looked up in that page table. And then we mentioned, well, this scheme for storing page tables, you know, it works better than trying to put it on the processor, but it doesn't actually scale to the kind of memory sizes we're used to, even with tricks like having pointers that are bigger than the number of bits we actually use to access memory. And we talked about sort of the very beginnings of our solution to that, and we said that most processors use a tree-like data structure where what the benefit is going to be that we're not going to store the parts of the table that would all be invalid. And we're going to use that tree data structure to sort of replace our array lookup so we don't have to store the parts of what would be in, you know, the complete tree that just represent all invalid entries. We'll look at what that looks like later today. So questions on the things we covered last time? Okay. Okay, so we mentioned this tree data structure. So, and I mentioned last time when we finished up that it's not going to be quite a search tree. And this is because of who's using it. This is something that the hardware is going to need to do lookups in. The OS is going to set it up, but the hardware actually does the lookups. And it's designed to make things simpler for the hardware. So this means that the lookup should be simple. We don't want to do any complicated calculations to compute what addresses to retrieve to find each node of the tree. So we're going to make it so this lookup works by splitting up the address more. So just like we kind of found the page number by taking some bits of the address, we want to find any indices we need for the lookups in this tree data structure by taking certain bits of the address. We don't want to do any calculations, any comparisons. We just want to take bits and put them somewhere. And also, we don't want to do many memory accesses. Why don't we want to do many memory accesses? Well, because doing two memory accesses is actually already very slow. In fact, it's so slow that we're going to talk later in the semester about a way of mostly not doing that. But if we had to do like 30 memory accesses, that would be a lot. So we want to kind of minimize that. And there's obviously a trade-off there, but to minimize that, we're going to try to make the tree have a really shallow depth. So what we end up with is this tree where each node is going to have a lot of children, and that's going to be true at each level. And because each node has a lot of children, we can have the tree be very shallow. And the number of children each node is going to have is going to be a power of 2. And that's going to let us split up our page number into pieces we use to index at each level, and I'll show what that looks like in an example on the next slide. So questions about these sort of hardware reasons why we're choosing this design? Yeah?
Yeah, for memory accesses, what's like the time scale for that?
So question, how long does the memory access take? So if we're actually doing an uncached memory access, that could be like, my back of the envelope would be like 50 to 100 nanoseconds. Typically, we hope the memory access is cached, and we'll learn that there's special caches for this lookup when we talk about caches in several weeks. I guess that I said that 50 to 100 nanoseconds is my back of the envelope. Like, obvious, it varies depending on what hardware you have and a lot of other things. So we're going to talk about this tree data structure. We're going to start with just having our tree have depth 2, basically. So we're going to have each node in our tree is going to be a page table. It's going to have the same format our single level, single page table had, but it's going to store a bit different information. So in our first level, we're going to have page table entries that are going to, like the page table entries we saw before, have a physical page number. And that physical page number, rather than being the page number where we find the program's data, it's going to be the page number where we find the second level page table. And that second level page table is going to have another page number. And in this case, it's two level page tables, so we're done with page tables. And that second level page table is going to contain the actual data the program's trying to access. And you might say, why is this saving any space? And the big reason why it's saving space is that when we have an entry in this first level, it's going to cover this whole big range of virtual page numbers. And if that whole range of virtual page numbers is all invalid, we're not going to bother making a second level page table for it, that whole range. We're just going to mark some of these entries as invalid. And that's where the space saving comes in. That because we don't need all the second level page tables, we're not going to store all of them. We're just going to say in the first level, there's nothing to see here. Yeah?
Would we do that with null pointers?
Would we do that with null pointers? So our page table entries are going to have the same format we saw before. We're going to have a valid bit. So the way we're going to indicate that it's invalid is by setting the valid bit to 0. And your question is, couldn't we do this with null pointers? And this is something that, yes, a processor could be built that way. Kind of a problem with that is maybe address 0 is valid in the hardware. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so we have these page tables. So our first level page table, it's going to look like the page tables we saw before. We're going to have a valid bit. We're going to have a physical page number. And we'll talk later about maybe some other bits we'll want. But rather than each row being for a particular virtual page number, it's going to be for a range of virtual page numbers. And for each of those ranges of virtual page numbers, we'll have the page table that contains the actual page numbers for that, for all the page numbers in that range. And we'll have chosen the size of the second level tables, and therefore the size of these ranges, to be powers of 2. And that means I can take the upper bits of my virtual page number, and that tells me what row I'm in this first level table. So I just take some bits of the virtual page number, that's my array index for this first level, and similarly I take some bits that I didn't use yet, and that's my index in the second level, as we'll see in a bit. And just like before, I have a valid bit that I'm going to check before I move on to the next level table, because if the valid bit 0, that means stop, trigger an exception, ask the OS what to do, the program tried to access something that doesn't make sense. And at our second level, so in this example, I have the second level page table that would be pointed to by this fourth entry here in the first level table. And this will be a second level page table that doesn't start at 0, it starts at virtual page number 300 and goes to, in this case, 3FF. So index 0 in this is going to be for virtual page number 300, index 1 is going to be for 301, and so on. So question? So the question is how many levels we have determined. So right now I chose 2 levels, and in a real processor, the processor will choose how many levels, and generally we'll make that choice based on how big are our addresses. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah. The question is, I wrote from OX300 to OX300, is that a typo? Yes. Should be OX3FF, matching the path. Other questions? That's this two-level page table structure. So how is this the hardware going to use this? Like, what's the machinery we're going to use to implement this lookup? So we're going to take our address, and we're going to have a page offset and a virtual page number. And the virtual page number is, in this case, going to be split up into 2 pieces. And we're going to take the first piece and do an array lookup. So how do we do an array lookup? We multiply our array index, which is our first part of the virtual page number, by the size of an array element. That's how many bytes into the array to go. We take the starting address of the array, which is going to be our page table base register. And this gives us the address of our page table entry from the first level. So we take that address, we process it, to get the parts of the page table entry. So remember, we get an integer, but we have to interpret that integer. The processor decides, where the valid bit is, where the page number is in there. So we split that, we check if it's valid. If it's not valid, we're going to cause a fault, we're done. If it is valid, then we still have to look up the next step. So we're going to have to get the starting address for the second page table, the second level page table. And we have a page number, but when we're accessing memory, we need an address. So I'm going to first convert my page number into an address by multiplying by the page size, which you might also know as sort of adding zeros. That's all we're doing here. So this is actually, even though this is I'm risk listing it as a multiplication, this is really simple in the hardware. We're just adding zeros to equal to the page offset. That's the same as multiplying by the page size. And this gets us the starting address of the second table. So this is the start of the second level table, just like our page table base register was the start of the first level table. So we take that starting address, we add how many bytes we want to go into the second level table, which is going to be based on the next part of the virtual page number. We're going to have to multiply that by the entry size to, you know, convert it from entries to bytes. And that gets us the address of our second level page table entry. And in this example, we have just two levels. So that's going to be where we're going to get the actual page number our program is trying to access. So we'll split that up into parts, and we'll get the physical page number out of there. That's the one the program is trying to access. We'll also check if it's valid. If it's invalid, we don't want to proceed. And we'll combine that page number with the page offset from the original address the program was trying to access, and that's where we'll actually access memory doing the read or write the program was trying to do. So overall, we have three accesses here to do one logical access. Some questions? Yes?
The depth looks like much larger. You'd have to have like more segments of the virtual address, right?
So question is, if the depth of this tree was larger, we'd have to have more segments? Yes. And for example, for a 64-bit address, we will need that. Okay. Other questions? Can I explain what the split PTE parts step is? So when we talked about, do I have this slide? So we talked about representing a page table entry as an integer, right? We said something like, we're going to represent it as this integer, and we're going to say, this is the valid bit, this is the page number, and this is unused. So that step is just extracting the valid bit, extracting the page number from that integer. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Is the unused segment furthest to the right?
The question is the unused segment furthest to the right. The format of page table entries is up to the processor. Whatever they want to do.
In the way you wrote it?
The way I wrote it, yes. It is the least significant bits. I'm not saying this is typical of any processor. Yeah.
On this slide, the
question on this slide, the virtual address is larger than the physical address. Is that possible? Absolutely. That is, in fact, probably the most common situation on computers today. Other questions? Yeah.
In first step, how do we know where to split it for individual parts?
Question, in the first step, how do they know where to split the virtual address?
Yeah.
Okay. So the question, the decision about like what size pieces, and this is a decision the processor makes about when it decides how, like, decides other things like how many levels are there. So it's going to decide how big are the parts of the address we use at each level. Commonly, processors will try and have all the parts be the same size. Obviously, that's not always possible. If I have 30 bits and I want to split them into three parts or into four parts, something's going to have to give. Most commonly, processors will have, if there's like an odd part out, it's going to be the first one. It's going to be most. But yeah, it's a decision the processor makes when it decides what the tree looks like. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, when does this data structure the processor is reading get created? That's the job of the OS, and it's done by the OS when it runs programs. Other questions? Okay. So another way we can view this process is we can kind of think of it as a bunch of array lookups. First, we're using the first part of the virtual page number to look up in the first page table, one array lookup. Then we're using using that as the base of an array, which we're doing another array lookup for the second part of the page table. And then the program's actual memory access is using the page offset as kind of an array lookup in that final actual physical page. And as people, I think, have mostly figured out, and I just did two levels because it's hard to fit more than two levels nicely on a slide, but real processors do more. Probably the most common version today would have four levels. We'll talk about so on the next slide. And generally, all but the last level, we're going to have pointers to another table, and then at the bottom level, we're going to have the actual pointers to the program's data. So in 64-bit x86, the most common configuration is that we have 48-bit virtual addresses, so that we have 64-bit pointers, but some of those bits aren't used. We have a 12-bit page offset, and that means we have 36 bits left for the virtual page number, because we have our address that is 48 bits that are actually used. We have some unused bits in a pointer that don't come up here. And the bottom, the least significant 12 bits here are the page offset. So that leaves us this 36-bit virtual page number that's 36 bits. And the most common configuration on 64-bit x86 divides that 36-bit virtual page number into four 9-bit chunks that are used for the lookup at each level. And because we want to represent poles sort of as one invalid entry, we always start with the first level lookup using the most significant bits. So a big chunk of addresses will have one entry in the first level that we can just mark as zero if it's all invalid. And the reason why they've chosen 9 bits for each is this means we have 2 to the 9 entries in every page table, and each page table entry is 8 bytes. So we have 2 to the 9 times 2 to the 3 bytes per page table, which means that we have 2 to the 12 bytes per page table. And that means page tables take up exactly one page. And that's a deliberate choice, and a very common choice processors will make, is that they'll design this tree structure so page tables are, when possible, exactly one page. Why is this convenient? Because when the operating system is allocating memory, it can do everything in pages. When it's giving memory to a program, it does it in a page, because that's the minimum unit it can set in the page table. And now with this page table design, when it's allocating memory for the page tables themselves, it can use the same procedure. Questions on this way of splitting up the addresses for our multi-level lookup? Yes? So the question is, isn't there a valid bit at each level? Does that make the page number size different? So if we look at this diagram here, so one representation, the valid bits are here. They're in the things we're looking up. They're not in the indexes we're using. So the indexes really are 9 bits, but there's a valid bit in the thing we look up using that index. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so one terminology note, When I've taught 3330, this has been a bigger problem, maybe because of the textbook we use in 3330, but it might come up in this class. The indices we use at each level are parts of the virtual page number. The virtual page number is the whole thing. Some people like telling me that the indices are, like, that the indices we use at each level are virtual page numbers, and we have four virtual page numbers. That's not the terminology you will generally see used. Okay, so that is about the structure of these multi-level page tables, but let's talk now about some of those extra bits. We kind of said, there's probably extra bits, let's talk about what those are and why you'd want them. And to give some motivation, here's sort of an example of what the layout of a program might look like. And you'll notice we have this big chunk up here labeled OS's memory. And in most operating systems, this is not the only option. This is where we have things like exception handlers. Sort of access to sort of other programs' data. And the most common operating system design, in fact, makes this region of virtual addresses, this is pre the translation, always map to the same addresses in physical memory. So we'll have several programs running, and if we look at the mapping they use, they'll all have a mapping that goes to the same OS memory region, even though their other stuff, like, is independent. And this is because the OS, when it runs, an exception happens, it needs to run, it needs to access its data, so that's shared between all programs. So questions on this idea of the OS's memory being shared in all the programs? Yes? So the question is, it's not like a copy of the exception handler is loaded every time we just point to the same one? Yes. So it's shared memory, kind of similar to the shared memory you set up in the signals lab, but for the OS's stuff. Okay. So questions? So a problem with this is that with the page tables we've seen so far, this would suggest that your program, your copy of Emacs, if it had a bug or maybe was malicious on purpose, it could just write things in here. It could change the exception handler. It could access the data of other programs. And we know that's not supposed to be possible. But this trick of having the OS's memory loaded, already available, ready to run in all programs is really nice. Because it means we don't have to like change the page tables when an exception happens. So how can we support that? And we're going to have a mechanism where we're going to modify our page tables to make it possible for us to have this stuff for the OS to use, but not let programs abuse it. And that mechanism is going to be, and we'll see more complete examples, that we're going to have an extra bit in every page table entry that says, can you access this part of memory in user mode or not? And every time we do a page table lookup, in addition to checking the valid bits, part of this etc. is we're going to check that extra bit and see, is this something that we're allowed to access in user mode if we're in user mode? If we're in kernel mode, we won't do the check. And this will let us mark the page table entries that are part of this shared memory in a way where they can be accessed when we're in kernel mode, but not otherwise. Question, yeah?
Is that the difference between a page fault and a protection fault?
Question, is that the difference between a page fault and a protection fault? Yes, when people distinguish between the two, that's the distinction they're usually making is a protection fault is based on these extra bits saying it's not okay, versus a page fault is usually based on the validity bit. I guess for protection faults caused by a memory access. Sometimes people use the word protection faults also to refer to like running a privileged instruction. Yes?
What if I can find that one bit that says, oh, I can run this in user mode?
where we're going to find that one bit. That's going to be an extra bit in our page table entries. I'll have an example on a future slide after we talk about some other extra bits we'll want. So all the bits there together that we might, some of them that we might have. So another thing that comes up when we're running programs is that, let's say I have two copies of Emacs. It's on Portal, one person's running Emacs, another person's running Emacs. And it would seem like we should be able to save some space if we're implementing the OS, because these two copies of Emacs both need to load a copy of the Emacs executable, which is not that small, and that should be the same data. And this is code and constants, it should never change. So we can just load a copy of it in both of them. But there's a problem here. So like, what if Emacs has a bug? And what if MST3K here triggers that bug, and that bug causes Emacs to have like an out-of-bounds pointer and overwrite data here? We'd say, well, hey, you're crashing your own copy of Emacs, whatever, that's not a big deal. Problem is that if this is actually shared, that would also crash XYZ's copy of Emacs. And we don't want that to be possible. But we still want to share this memory. We don't want to actually have to make an extra copy for every user running the program. And so our solution to that is we'll have additional extra bits indicating what operations you're allowed to do to that memory in our page table entries. So our page table entries, rather than just having a valid bit in a physical page, we might have, for example, a can you access it in user mode? Can you write to it? Can you execute from it? And every time we do a memory access, we're going to check these bits. And if these bits don't match what type of access we're trying to do, the processor is going to trigger an exception, tell the OS, hey, this program tried to do something you told me it shouldn't do. And the OS gets to decide what to do about that, and it could, for example, crash the program. So this means that we can mark this data here as executable and not writable. So we don't have to worry about MST3K's copy of Emacs having a bug and overwriting it. If that happens, it will try to overwrite it, that will trigger an exception, and the OS can crash the program. Yes?
So is the Emacs exe linked for both the users, and that's why like you don't want to be able to write one to affect another?
Question is, the Emacs exe linked for both the users? So a goal here is that we don't want to have to load Emacs twice into memory if we're implementing the OS. So this is an optimization we want to do, right? The naive thing would be every time you start Emacs, we load a new copy of it into memory. So we're trying to avoid that, and this is something that's going to allow us to do that even though we have multiple users and Emacs might be buggy. Does that answer your question? Yes.
So, tripping the executable bit or something like that, that would also be a protection call, right? Just like the violating.
So the question is, if my access doesn't conform to these bits, that would generally be a protection fault? Yes. So I guess that would be commonly called a protection fault. I'm not going to be picky about distinguishing between page faults and protection faults in this class, and this is partly because some processors aren't either. Some processors just say, there's a page fault, to find out why it happened, check this register, and it will be set slightly differently if it's based on the user bit or the valid bit or whatever. Yeah? Question, can the super user change these permission bits? And the answer, the short answer is no, because in our program, these page tables, if you can access them, they're up here. So we can't write that no matter who we're running as, because we're all code that's not OS code always runs in user mode. The longer answer is that probably there's some sort of system call the OS provides that might let you do that, like for a debugging interface or something like that. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
What are like the page table process for these bits?
What part of the page table process are these bits checked? Generally, they're going to be checked at every single level of the lookup. So when we check the valid bits to see if we should keep going, we also check the user bit, the write bit, and all these other bits, whatever the processor decides to have. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah. How does the OS know what to set these bits to when it's modifying the page tables? So the format of the page tables will be defined by the processor. So there'll like be a literal manual that tells you, here's what the page table look like. I guess I didn't include the slide with the picture from Intel's manual for that, for example. So we'll know that. And the OS is the one running programs, so it knows what parts of the program's memory need to be readable, writable, and so on. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
So when you're using the virtual page number to look up the page number, how do you know whether the call to access that memory was prior to writing the text?
So the question is, when the processor is doing the lookup using the virtual page number to get our physical page number, how does it know what the access is trying to do? That is something the processor needs to take into account. And how the processor is running an instruction. So it can know from the context of that instruction what type of access it is. So if it's an instruction that moves a value into memory, it's a write. If it's a jump, or if it just jumped and it's trying to fetch code, it's executing. If it's an instruction that just reads a value, it's a read, and so on. The question is, does that mean when you're checking those bits, you're only checking the ones that call is trying to do? Yes. So in our model so far, yes. So if you're thinking ahead, I mentioned we're going to do caching. So we're going to somehow not repeatedly do these lookups. So our solution when we're doing caching is that we're going to remember what the bits were, and so we're going to recheck it on every access, but we're going to not repeat the lookup somehow. But we're going to have recorded what those bits were so we can check it again later. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so just to interlude, so we have an assignment coming up for the next homework, which is a bigger assignment. And in the assignment, you're going to implement an API with two calls, one called translate, which is meant to do a page table lookup. You might say, in what page table? In a page table you create, which you're going to create when we call page allocate. So this is a page table that we're kind of simulating. So the physical addresses we're dealing with are going to be your program's addresses, and the virtual addresses are going to be the numbers we pass to translate. And our goal is that we specify what virtual addresses we want to want by passing them to page allocate, and after that, you allocate memory in your program's addresses for that, such that when I call translate with that same address, I get that memory. And you do this following a particular page table format we specify in the assignment that we're going to check on a grading. And the final version of this is going to support multi-level page table lookups. There's also some other requirements in the assignment, like we have code style requirements. So we have a make file, we have a README with certain things that need to be in it, we have a license file because we want you to learn that software you find online that's free doesn't mean you could do anything with it. And there are multiple deadlines since this is a big assignment. Most of the points will be for the final submission. The purpose of the earlier deadlines is that my experience in teaching courses with large homework assignments is that if I only have one deadline, people interpret this as, oh, this is just like any other assignment. I don't really need to start until 3 days before that deadline, even though you gave me conspicuously 3 weeks to do it. So there are other deadlines, but a vast majority of the points are for the final submission, and we'll recheck all the functionality on the final submission. So if you don't implement something for the first submission, we're still going to grade it on the next one. And for the first submission, you have a bunch of choices about what parts you implement or complete. Also, there's three submissions. After the second submission, there's a code review that will be done in lab. So we'll have you go in lab, go in groups of ideally three, and review the other people's code. And there's a submission after that where I would hope you would take advantage of that code review and fix your code to make it better. So questions on sort of what's in the assignment and logistics for it? Yes.
Yeah, so I looked at it, and it, for style, it was like a four-space implementation. Is there like a particular OS reason why we need to do it that way, or is that just like a style?
This question is, in the coding style we specify four-space indentation, so that is arbitrary choice, but we want everyone to be consistent. And I guess I would say, like, if we're thinking of real-world experience, if you're working on any real software project, you really should follow the coding style the software project follows, and not your personal preference. You might like two-space indention. That's not very nice to add to a project with four-space indention, and then I try to read the code of that project, and it's all mixed up. Other questions? Yes, back there. So question, what the physical address is for this project. So what we're going to do is we're going to have this translate function where we put in sort of our virtual addresses and the translate function. And then that goes to sort of your program memory. And that's the equivalent of our physical address. So we're going to be able to, for example, translate, say address 100 to get a pointer and C code calling your code. I should probably make this a pointer to something we can actually access. So I can call translate to get a pointer, and then I can dereference that pointer, and set it to a value, and we'll access memory in my program. So our physical addresses are the real pointers in C. Our virtual addresses are the numbers we're going to pass to translate and page allocate, and translate needs to give us these physical addresses that are really your program addresses. And we can kind of think of as sort of fake virtual, fake physical, and those fake physical addresses are really the real machine's virtual addresses, which translate to physical addresses you'll never see. Does that answer your question? Yes, back there?
Are they,
or are they? So are the program addresses simulated? By the program addresses, I mean you're writing C code, the addresses you see in your C code. Does that answer your question? So they're real in the sense that you really see them in your C code. So that seems like I didn't answer your question.
I guess I'm like, the addresses that we see in our C code, but I guess I'm like a little confused.
Sorry?
I guess I'm confused as to what you mean by these are addresses we see in your C code.
So, that you see in our address you see in your virtual machine. So you're going to write some C functions, translate and page allocate. Your C functions are going to deal with pointers. The pointers you deal with, those are our equivalent of physical addresses. Even though we know really they're virtual addresses, we're kind of simulating on top of our normal machine this page table stuff. So our simulation is on top of virtual addresses. We're kind of adding another layer of virtual addresses. Is that clearer? Okay. Yeah.
So what's the order that you call page allocate and translate? So are you doing page allocate with parameter translate number so translate will give you an invisible address and then you pass that?
So the question is, how does page allocate interact with translate?
Yeah, or what?
So, this is hopefully described in more detail in the assignment, but basically, once I call page allocate x, translate x will give me a valid pointer. If I don't call page allocate x, translate x will only give me a valid pointer if I've called page allocate for something that's in the same page. same simulated page. Does that answer your question? Yes.
What .c files do we have for the homework?
What .c files do we have for the homework? We do not specify.
Yeah.
So choose reasonable naming conventions, and code style is part of the thing, so I would consider it bad style if your C files are named file1.c, file2.c, but probably you won't do that. Yes?
Does the virtual page number, can we assume that it's divided into equal chunks depending on how many levels we have for this assignment?
It's a question for the virtual page number, can we assume it's divided into equal chunks depending on how many levels we have? I believe we specify very explicitly how it's divided, and yes, it's divided evenly. And also, the effective virtual address size is not the constant, depending on how we configure things, as specified in the assignment. That answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. And as I mentioned, there's a part of the assignment which we probably won't, most of you probably will do later, but which is about licenses. So one thing that we kind of wanted to fit in the curriculum somewhere, and this course got chosen because, well, all the places aren't like the greatest fit, is talking about software licenses. And the big thing is that, you know, just because you're given code doesn't mean, you know, it doesn't have conditions. Now, software licenses are mostly kind of legal things, and this is not a law class. I am not an expert in the law. You should not trust me for legal advice. And I'm not qualified to say what things that licenses purport to restrict are legally enforceable or not. But even if we ignore the legal aspect, you know, a big reason why we want you to understand this is when people put code online for you to use, they often kind of have expectations that come along with that about what you should and should not do with that code. They don't just, you know, people who put something up on GitHub with an open source license, often, you know, their thought and the sort of statement they've made by choosing that license isn't that this code is free for everyone to use. It's something more nuanced. They have some things they think are okay for you to do and some things they don't. So we want you to kind of explore that a little bit, just to have done that in your undergraduate career, and also, like, hopefully not make the biggest mistakes people have in industry of, like, oh, I found this code online. It's great to incorporate into our product, and then the lawyers find this out, and someone has to spend 8 months re-implementing something. So, questions about the licenses part of our assignment? Okay, so talked about sort of the mechanics of doing a page table lookup, and that page tables can help the processor enforce restrictions on how memory are used, these with these extra bits, commonly called permissions bits, so it's permissions but for memory instead of files. But there's some other things that happen with page tables that are maybe a bit less intuitive. I guess we'll skip those. So one thing, example we can give is, let's say I have my program memory here, and I have this stack. And if I want to support all programs, I need to decide how big this stack should be by default. And sometimes I'm running a program where someone has implemented Ackerman, and this stack needs to be like megabytes. Sometimes I'm running a program which doesn't use much any recursion, uses pretty small functions, and I might need like only a few kilobytes of stack. And it would seem that if our defaults are going to support that Ackerman program, that when our OS starts our program, it's going to have to allocate a huge amount of space that's just wasted. But page tables are going to allow us to do better. Page tables are going to give us a mechanism where we can give the program the impression that we've allocated all this space, in case they're that Ackerman program, but only actually allocated if it's really needed. And the mechanism for that is going to be that we're not going to allocate it. So our page table is going to have entries that are marked as invalid. And then the program is going to try to use this thing we didn't allocate. So in this example, we're running a push instruction. The push instruction is going to try to write to the stack beyond where the stack space is actually allocated. And since our stack pointer is right, you know, at the bottom of the page 7FFFC, the next access will, you know, decrement the stack pointer, and we'll go to page 7FFFB. So that's going to cause a page fault, because the processor is going to look up this page table entry I've highlighted here. It's going to check the valid bit, find out the valid bit 0, say, no can do. And what a page fault does is it doesn't crash your program, it runs the OS. The OS decides what happens after that. And the OS can figure out, oh, this happened because the program tried to access that stack space I promised it. And since I promised it that space, I'm not going to crash it because I promised this would work. So I'm going to make it work. How am I going to make it work? I'm going to look up that there was supposed to be stack there and fix the page table. I'm going to allocate the space now. Now the page table's good. The instruction would work. And we'll just go back from our exception handler, and it will restart this operation. And this time, it will work. So there won't be any more exception, and the program will just moving on, just as if that space was allocated in advance, except we just did it at the last possible moment. Yes?
So was that space like always technically available? It just didn't let the program initially have it, and the OS updated it and gave it permission to use it?
So the question is, was that space always technically available? So there's two parts of the question. So one part is, was that space always technically available? And the other part, was it just some space that existed that it just updated permission for the program to use it? So I would say, was the space technically available? Yes, because if the program tried to use it, it would work. So it was always available. Was it just updating kind of the permissions on the space? So the OS had the choice here of how it decided that physical address. So potentially, the OS might have not even done the work of figuring out what physical address it would give the program until this happened. And that means that if the program never requests this space, the OS never does that work. And that's kind of a big advantage. This. Yeah?
So would this be more likely to work for like a write access, like decrementing, or like pushing something to the stack than reading? Would the OS just not cooperate if you tried to read beyond your memory?
So the question is, what happens for reading? So if we've promised we've allocated the space, reading should work, which means the OS is going to allocate the page and put it whatever initial value pages have. Probably all zeros, but it's up to the OS. And we'll talk on the next slide about a case where reading is the most common thing because the OS doesn't have to start the page out with zeros. Yeah?
How does the OS differentiate between like running out of space and needing more space versus an actual like invalid memory access?
So the question is, how does the OS distinguish between a page fault where it should fill in the space versus invalid memory access? The way it's going to distinguish that is the hardware is going to let the OS figure out what address the program is trying to access. And the OS is going to have something like this picture. I'll probably show you what that looks like on a future slide for Linux. But it's going to have something like this picture, and it's going to look on its data structure that represents this picture to figure out what's supposed to be there. And if it finds out that the address is like in this hole here, it's going to say, kill the program. If it finds something in the stack area, it's going to give it the space. Does that answer your question?
Would the exception created by the hardware be the same regardless of which case it is?
Question, would the exception created by the hardware be the same regardless of which case? Yes. The hardware has not been given the information about what the OS actually thinks is the memory layout. All it's been given are the things in the page table. Other questions? Yeah.
Yeah. So, when the OS like keeps the picture of that, like the bookkeeping, would it like always give the program more pages so that it doesn't try to access like readout space, or like could you access readout space and then it will just give you another page there?
So the question is, if you access that readout space, will the OS just give you more pages, or will it Not, that is a decision that the OS gets to make. So, right, the OS is writing the exception handler, so it decides in what cases exactly it will give you more space. So typically they'll have, so like for stack space, typically they'll have some choice for how much space they decided to give you. And if you go beyond that, they'll just kill your program. Yes?
Is there a particular place that the OS will reallocate the physical page taking up the stack space?
Question, is there a place where the OS would reallocate the physical page taking up the stack space? What do you mean by the physical page taking up the stack space? Or what do you, sorry, yeah.
The area that was supposed to be allocated for the stack was actually being optimized to have the page.
Okay. You mean, so place where the OS will like do filling in this entry that we saw here.
It was some important data.
Some important data that.
Like that physical page, if it's something important, where would it reallocate that if it's changing the pages?
So if this physical page here, the one we put in the page table entry, if that was important, where would it? How would it change it to something else? So the assumption is when the OS sets the page table entry, that it has chosen the page it puts there. But through some data structures it has, where it tracks sort of all the physical pages it's used. And most commonly, it's going to have sort of a list of physical pages that currently are unoccupied, and that's probably where it would get this number from. And that would be how it would avoid, you know, unintentionally allocating space another program needed. Other questions? Yes. Yes.
So the OS basically just has a range of addresses for each different memory chunks. So for the stack, it might have a minimum address range and a maximum address range. And if the program tries to access within that range, then it might just allocate more.
So the question is, you're saying the OS has a range of address trunks for each memory region, and if the program tries to access beyond that range, it might allocate a bit more. So, is that your question?
Not exactly. So this just has like a minimum range for the stack, and then like a maximum range. And if it falls within the maximum range, then it will allocate more. But if it tries to access anything over that range, then it will crash the program.
So the question is, for the stack, it has like a minimum and a maximum. And if it tries to access within that, it will allocate it. Otherwise, it will crash the program. Yes. And I guess I can skip ahead to my list. So, I showed the wrong thing here. Well, I guess I can't skip ahead to that easily. So if you type, so on Linux, you can like dump the ranges, and basically the OS has a list it stores in Linux for each process where it says, this is the range of virtual addresses, and they are readable and executable, and they come from, in this case, bin caps. So the OS tracks the information at that type of granularity. Let's go back to our allocating space on the back example. So I mentioned allocating space for the stack, where basically when the program tries to access something, we just give it some new empty memory. But we can also apply this concept for space that isn't initially empty. So for example, we can load from disk using this same technique. And in fact, this is commonly how loading programs works on many OSs. Is that rather than loading the whole program from disk, the OS will load the program from disk as the program tries to access stuff. So it will just record this part of memory should come from the program and just create a page table with things not filled in yet, and if the program tries to access those things, it can start filling them in as things actually get loaded from the disk. And this has a big advantage that it makes starting programs faster, that to start a program, we don't need to load all the code of the program, we just need to load the code we're executing now. Some questions? This idea, so we can do the loading on demand idea, you know, not, we can allocate space that's a copy of file on disk in the same way. Yes?
So like, the way it handles the stack is
Question is, the way it handles the stack the same as for the heap? It could be, yes. So I've said that this is an option for the stack. I'm not guaranteeing all OSs do it. And the same would apply for the heap. It's an option for managing the heap, but it's not required that the OS do it this way. It could set up all the space in advance, and that's kind of, there's a trade-off. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. And in the signals lab, to get shared memory, use this call called mmap. And what mmap does is it loads a file in your memory. And the way it works is it uses this mechanism, where it's kind of loaded on demand from that file. And I fortunately didn't hide the things I wanted to on this slide, which I'll have to fix later. But on Linux, the way Linux manages memory is it kind of treats it as a list of mmap calls. So when you call mmap, you specify, I want to map this much of this file and get some memory. So Linux kind of treats the program memory as a list of regions that are mapped to a file, and as a special case, that file can be fresh memory instead of a file. So everything is implemented using this kind of allocate-on-demand mechanism on Linux, where it will load it from a file, or in some special cases, from just new empty space. But all it's tracking is this list of this address to this address is readable, and comes from, in this case, mincat. This address to this address is readable and not executable, and comes from mincat and more of those. That's sort of what it thinks of as the memory of a program. This idea of doing things to page tables in response to sort of page or protection faults by not assuming the page or protection fault's really an error, this can do things more than just kind of loading data on demand. So one example of a thing it can do is that a thing called swapping, which is actually kind of the original purpose of virtual memory. And this is the idea is here is that we use the disk or SSDs or some other sort of thing that isn't like memory but is storage as the next level of our memory hierarchy, that to store things that don't fit in normal memory. But you can still access it like normal memory. And the program will allocate program space not in real memory but, say, on disk and move things from disk to memory and back again as the program tries to use it. And the moving things from disk to memory, that's our allocating on demand. Moving things in the other direction is just removing it from memory and marking those page table entries as invalid. What if the program tries to access it again? Well, you load it from disk again. So this idea of swapping is actually kind of the original reason why virtual memory was designed the way it is. Now, these days, a lot of OSs support swapping, and in fact use it by default, but it's not really something you want to be happening all the time. And the reason why is over time, the gap between how fast memory is and how fast hard drives and solid-state disks are has grown. So reading from a hard drive takes milliseconds to tens of milliseconds. And if you did the timing assignment kind of correctly, you might think, gosh, a lot could happen in 10 milliseconds. It would be really inconvenient if, like, pushing something on the stack took 10 milliseconds. That could make things really bad. SSDs are faster, but it's still, like, hundreds of microseconds. So it's not really something you want to be doing all the time. And another thing with it is that when we do swapping, if we want to let program A load something from the memory, then we're going to have to free up space in the memory, which typically means some other program is going to have stuff unloaded. And this means that if we actually are really taking advantage of this, you know, we're going to be doing a lot of moving things around, and it's more than just the stuff we're loading from disk. It's also the stuff we're sending back to disk and possibly back and forth if both these program A and program B are doing a lot. Though, something we can do when we're doing this is that we can, you know, run other programs while we're writing things to disk. So, you know, it's not quite as bad for the system's performance as, you know, it takes 5 milliseconds, because during that 5 milliseconds where we're reading from the disk, we can run something else. We can switch to another program. And when that disk read is finished, we can switch back to the original program. So at least something is being done, just not the program that have its stuff loaded. Yes?
Why don't we just have a very big RAM without the disk?
Why don't we just have a very big RAM without the disk? So that is kind of the majority solution today. And that's mainly because disks are so much slower than RAM. So typically that's the sort of design we'll use today. But today the same mechanism is used like for loading the program the first time. Like it's the same code in the OS. It's just mostly used for like loading the program from disk into RAM once and things like that. Or for, it turns out, like trying to keep copies of files that are on disk and RAM as much as possible. Same ideas apply to doing that. Back when virtual memory was conceived, the gap between performance of disks and main memory was much smaller, like maybe 10x at most. I don't actually know the numbers, but it was much smaller, so this made a lot more sense to do. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
So when you say the difference has grown over time, is that just like you've designed better RAM that access faster,
So the question is, why has the difference grown over time? So memory and disks have gotten faster over time. But memory has gotten more faster than disks have gotten faster. Does that answer your question? Okay, so that's one thing. And another thing we can do comes with some another part of this memory. So we have, you know, let's say we have two copies of program. I, for some reason, changed program, but we have two copies of bash. And I have my code in that constants. I can share that as read-only. You figure that out. But I have this thing called writable data. This would be like where our global variables are. And typically, the way that works is for global variables that aren't initially zero, we'll have like the initial values in the executable. And the idea is we copy those initial values into memory. And if the program modifies those global variables, like changes them a little bit, we'll change those. And it seems like that these can't be shared. Because these are sort of global variables which could be modified, we have to have them be separate, independent copies. But if we think of a program like Bash, probably a lot of these global variables represent settings we're mostly not changing. So they're mostly going to be the same. And if, you know, they're unchanged, it would be nice to like not have two copies of them every time if we're running two copies of bash. To only have one copies of most of that stuff which isn't changed. And we can in fact do this. So we can share data which is writable, because it's fine to share it until it's modified. So we can share it as long as it isn't modified. Well, what do we do if it's modified? Then we stop sharing it. So the question is, can we detect when it's modified? And the answer is yes. Yes, we can. And the reason we can is we can just pretend to the CPU, we can tell the CPU, this memory is read-only. The program is going to try to write it. That's fine. Just like it was fine when the program tried to access that stack space we didn't allocate. It's fine because we can remember why we said it read-only. We didn't set it read-only because it's really read-only. We set it read-only because we need to make a copy of it later. So when we're running our two copies of bash with different writable data, we can just have them initially share all that space, and let's, if they get tried to access it, then we can copy just that page that it tried to access. But we can leave everything that it didn't try to write yet shared. So this idea is called copy on write. And this is something that OSs actually pretty commonly do for one reason or another, because it kind of lets us share things until they're modified. That actually comes up a lot in real programs, especially on Unix. We'll learn about something called fork later, which like stresses this mechanism. Yes?
So when we start writing to the program, it's not shared anymore?
Question, so when we start writing to the program, it's not shared anymore? Yes. Though, note that we only need to unshare the parts that are modified. So like in this example, if the program only accessed this page, modified this page, all the other pages are still shared. Does that answer your question? Yes.
So when you try to write, it triggers like some kind of fault. The OS sees it and changes it, so you can actually write it, but also makes a copy.
So the question is, when you try to write, it triggers some kind of fault. The OS sees it and changes it, so you can actually write it, but makes a copy? Yes, exactly. Question there? Question in that copy remains read-only? No, that copy is writable, because if we didn't make it writable, so the scenario that's happening when we make the copy is very similar to our scenario here, where some instruction was trying to write. And if we don't make it writable, we're going to restart that instruction, and what's going to happen immediately? It's going to try to write. And that write's going to fail. So we need to make it writable, or else we'll have like an infinite loop of keeping it trying to write. So the question is, the question is, when I make the copy, the original is still there, and is the original writable now? Or is it left readable? In this example, I left it readable. We could have made it writable. It's up to how the OS implements this. So, see if I have my corrected version of this slide. Yes, okay. And so I mentioned that to support all these tricks where what the memory region does is different than what's in the page table, the operating system needs to track that memory in a different way. So in Linux, if you look at proc PID, or self for your own PID maps, it will dump the data structure that's used internally by the OS. So we can see what Linux tracks for the memory of a program for itself that the processor doesn't see is it says, oh, I know this part of the program's memory, this range of addresses is readable and executable and comes from bin cap. And it uses that information to fill in the page table. And it has all these entries for all the parts of this program's memory. So we see that some of the memory comes from libc, that dynamically linked library we talked about earlier. Some of it is reserved for the stack, so it's going to be allocated as needed, you know, with empty space. And this is what Linux looks up when it needs to do something to fill in a page table, which it could do in advance, or it could do as the program tries to access memory and it gets faults from the processor saying, hey, the program tried to access memory that you didn't set up yet. You can look at this list and figure out what to do about that. Yes? Question, these are virtual addresses? Yes, these are all virtual addresses. So this is what's used to fill in the page table, but I'm not showing anything about how it chooses what physical addresses to use. That's a topic that you might discuss if you take an OS class. Other questions? Okay, so that concludes our unit on virtual memory. So probably. So next time, we'll be focusing on networking. So next big topic.